This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, one ring to rule them all. Magical artifacts that make the hero.
So, Jules, sorry, I've just noticed that every single episode ever, I always start it with so. It just seems to be a pattern that is forming. I need to try and break it. All right, Jules. There we go. That worked better. All right, Jules. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you think, I just wish you could be walking along in your ordinary life, just doing ordinary things, and then something drops into your hands and it ends up pulling you on a magnificent adventure where you are become the ultimate hero?
I think that's a reasonable. I don't see anything wrong with that as a fantasy.
I love the simplicity. I go through this long, detailed question. And you just, yeah.
Want to slam it? Yeah, I'm up for that. I'm in there.
To be honest, I think it's something that everyone has kind of dreamt of. And I, you know, a part of me thinks it's why a lot of people are into antiques.
Yes. It's that and hunt into for the unusual. It's the hunt for the grail again, isn't it?
Yeah, and like I love unusual stuff. My brother bought me this gourd for Christmas, which has got leather wrapping. It's not really leather, I don't think. But of a map, a really old map, over this sort of green bottle, and it's great. And I call it the Gourd of Antioch. I don't know why I call it the Gourd of Antioch. I was probably thinking of the Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch. But anyway, I really loved it because I held it in my hands. I thought any second now I could open this and a genie could pop out, or it could have a map inside of it, or you know, things along those lines where you pick something up and think, there is nothing quite like this in the world. I'm holding something which is about to start the adventure.
No, I know what you mean. And again, it's very much like you're saying genie, obviously Aladdin and the lamp. And I know he obviously didn't just find it lying around on a street corner, but that did start the whole next course of his life for him after being tricked.
Yeah. And it is a big thing that we tend to see in fiction, where someone is going through their ordinary lives and usually they're a little bit down on their luck at the same time. So they're down on luck. Things are not going right for them. And they're maybe betraying themselves a little bit. Maybe they're a little bit cowardly. Maybe they, you know, that they're not actually getting what they want from life. You can see room for growth within them. They could be they're a good person, but they could be a great person and they haven't reached that yet. You know, as it says in Aladdin, he's a diamond in the rough.
Yeah. It is the hero's journey, isn't it?
Yeah. And then something drops into their hands, and that thing that drops into their hands is the inciting incident. It's the change. And that object is usually the most important object of the story, even though it actually doesn't tend to be important in that it's not the main character. It's not something which is incredibly prominent, but it's the key. It's the linchpin of the entire story. And it propels this character through their story, and in the end they won't necessarily need this thing to be able to kind of get to tell the story, but it's the essence, it's the center of the story. So we might as well start with Aladdin, because we've just mentioned it before. So Aladdin is very much a typical one where when you think of Aladdin, you don't actually think of the magic lamp as being the center of the story, but it is obviously the center of the story. Because when you think of Aladdin, you think of the genie himself.
Yeah. But I mean, the whole thing about the lamp is it's very unprepossessing, isn't it? The fact that in the original tale from 1001 Nights, Aladdin's wife trades it when the peddler comes by seeing new lamps for old, because she thinks, oh, well, that's a rubbish old lamp, I'll get a new lamp for it, and trades away the one with the genie in.
Awkward.
It's awkward, and perhaps the best mystical objects are the ones which hide in plain sight.
Yeah, well, it's as they Indiana Jones and not Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones and
Temple of Doom.
No, other one. It's other one.
Crusade?
With
Crystal
Last
Skull?
Crusade with Sean Connery in it. Sean Connery Jr., that one.
Yeah.
The great one. Where actually the Holy Grail turns out to be the really unassuming wooden cup. That you know, there was a little bit of sort of, sorry, just small tangent about that film. It was a fantastic film. But they drink from the cup, right? And then he uses the cup to heal his father. But his father then still dies later on. So like, does it not give? What's the rule there?
Doesn't he use the cup to pour water over his father's wound to heal him? Doesn't actually
Yeah.
drink from it?
I don't know,
And
but
more to the point, does it make Indiana Jones immortal?
yeah, because Indiana Jones drank from it, but Harrison Ford would apparently disagree that he's
Anyway, obviously that's a minor plot hole. It obviously doesn't take away from the fact that it's a great film.
it's a fantastic film. That was a brilliant, utterly brilliant film. So yes. It's something gets dropped into your hands, and it is the thing that forces the change. And usually it forces change by putting you in immediate danger.
Yes, or you've been put in immediate danger and a mentor figure will hand you something.
Now, can you give me an example of that where you've been put into immediate danger and a mentor will hand you something?
Northern
Like to
Lights, Lyra gets handed the alethiometer before she's taken away by Mrs. Coulter, by the Oxford scholar.
Yes.
Because she doesn't really realise she's even going into danger, but they can't keep Lyra when her father's in prison. And he thinks the alethiometer might help. He knows how to read the alethiometer himself, and everything's telling him that it will be of some assistance to Lyra. This tantalizing hint
Yeah.
of things that will happen in future books.
Yeah. I think another example of that is actually in the Star Wars series with the lightsaber. Which again, you don't necessarily, especially in the new one, and I say it's new one, it's not actually that new anymore.
Force Awakens.
The Force Awakens, yeah. Rey picks up the lightsaber, and that's kind of really when her destiny comes calling, actually.
Yeah, before that, all she's interested in is going back and clinging to the past. So it's
Yeah,
at the point
and
where
the
she's
lights.
decided she's going to make a change.
Yeah, and the lightsaber actually sort of awakens something in her in a very interesting way. She doesn't earn it. She doesn't have to suffer for it. Doesn't have to do anything. Like, I mean, she has suffered, but she doesn't have to suffer to get it. It just she ends up picking it up by accident, really. And that propels her to make the decision that initially she doesn't want to have to make. And then she does. And actually, it's through picking up that lightsaber she becomes aware of her own ability with the Force and things along those lines.
Yeah.
So that again is an item which isn't of the greatest. In fact, it's almost seems insignificant to the plot, and yet it plays that essential role of being the thing which projects the character into becoming the hero they are at the end. Another example of that is the one that is told again and again, where it's not actually an object, it's a creature. And one example is the finding of a dragon egg, or the finding of, you know, any egg, to be honest. Did you ever pick up an egg and just try and hatch it and think, what could it be?
I don't think I ever tried to hatch an egg, no. And thanks to my somewhat nerdy upbringing, I could identify most of the wild eggs I found.
Lardy bloody dar.
Sorry about that. That wasn't the area of fantasy stretched into.
But yeah, everyone loves the idea of finding a dragon egg. I mean, that's essentially what happens with Daenerys in Game of Thrones, in A Song of Ice and Fire. She gets presented with these three dragon eggs,
Yeah, which are supposedly fossilized.
which someone probably should have checked that first. and yeah, that I mean, the fact that she has dragons pretty much propels her through the rest of the series
Yeah,
after they hatch.
we're back into I've got three flying thinking nuclear bombs on my side. What have you got?
Yeah, very little.
I've got Lady Mormont. Oh, okay, I'm backing off then.
She was badass. Anyway,
No, looking at the object presaging destiny, if you look at Robin Jarvis's first trilogy, The Depth of Mice, very early on in the book, it's a really lovely, well-imagined world, and the mice have this their religion is they worship the green gods that humans used to, and they personify it as the green mouse, which sort of makes sense really, because you try and tend to make your gods look a bit like you. And they have a coming of age ceremony for young mice where they receive their mouse brasses. And the mouse brass is basically a little pendant, and they pick them blind out of a bag, having gone through a ceremony where they have to walk through winter into spring and summer. These are set up rooms, as it were. And the mouse brass they pick tells them what their destiny will be. So, for example, a house mouse will have a mouse brass with, a wedge of cheese carved into it. And in the first book, Dark Portal, Audrey, the main character, manages to pick out a mouse brass with a cat's head, which is like the anti-cat charm. And her nemesis throughout the books is a, I'm sorry if no one's read these, is a cat called Jupiter, which is an evil, monstrous, magic-wielding cat that's been alive since the time of Elizabeth I, living in the sewers of Deptford. Absolutely cracking book. In some ways, it seems like quite a heavy-handed way to foreshadow what's going to happen in the books. In another way, it's not, because the character herself cannot make sense of the fact that she seems to have pulled this weighty destiny out of the bag, and the mice haven't had any enemies for centuries. Even, the rats are pretty tame. So, it's really interesting. I'm sure that sort of idea has been used before, where a character gains something like a horoscope, or during their naming ceremony or whatever, when they become a main member of the tribe, they're told what their destiny is going to be broadly.
And so that's an object which is not actually physical, but it's an object of knowledge, I guess, in some ways. It's a concept that gets introduced to them, and basically whether they reject it, whether they accept it, kind of drives the rest of the plot.
In a lot of ways, though, the specific mouse brass that Audrey picks out of the bag during her ceremony, does drive the rest of the plot of that book and the following two books, because her father went missing the day before her coming of age ceremony, and she thinks he's gone down into the sewers, which are dangerous because the rats are down there. So she goes looking for him, and there's all sorts of trouble, and during a scuffle she loses her mouse brass, and so she ends up sending other mice to go and look for it for her, because her mother has made a promise she won't ever go back, not even to look for her father, and she doesn't want to break the promise to her mother, so she guilts someone else into going for her. And as it turns out, this is how they all end up finding out about and defeating Jupiter, because they're on this quest to get this mouse brass back, which seems so important at the beginning, and it draws them in direct conflict with this god in the sewers, and you find out what he's really up to. And then it progresses into the second book and the third book.
But the mouse brass itself doesn't actually isn't it.
It is magical. You don't find that until much, much later, but it generally cat charms aren't made by the mice anymore, because they haven't seen a cat in generations, mouse generations anyway.
Very interesting. Another interesting thing is there's a theme, which is that often with male sent stories, the thing that they end up getting presented with is a sword. And that probably dates back quite a lot to well, I think King Arthur. The King Arthur mythos is a fantastic place to start, which is young boy, pretty ordinary, nothing special really going on in his life. picks up a sword and becomes King of England. I didn't vote for you. With really very little effort on his part, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a sense of, well, blood will out, isn't it, if you're just going from the myths and legends.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's where it kind of maybe comes from a little bit. But you know, you made an observation earlier pre-episode that it was rather phallic.
Well, yeah, it seems to be a boy to man type journey, doesn't it? And it's almost like you're presenting them with a slightly more effective penis.
A boy finds his sword and becomes a man.
Yeah. But, you know, there's probably form for this that goes beyond myth and legend back to, you know, when we were still making swords out of bronze.
Yeah.
And we hadn't yet worked out how to make iron, and certainly hadn't worked out how to make steel. And that was, it was too valuable to just, you know, chuck away or whatever. So it would be passed on. It's not, I mean, you didn't tend to find bronze swords and things buried with people. They found them at the bottom of lakes and things, which were given as offerings, which is slightly different.
So yeah.
That might be where the whole Lady of the Lake thing dated.
Yeah, that's true. And another suggestion is that the sword from the stone meant actually the actual sword from taking a sword from a stone. So the first sword wielded, taken from ore, from iron. Which is an interesting idea. And so that wasn't gaining an object, it was making an object, working for an object. And yeah, the, you know, all phallic joking aside, there probably was an element of truth to it, which is that you got a sword when you were ready probably to learn to fight, to protect the family, to do battle. And it wasn't just men. It was girls as well. So there was this, it was very much a, you are no longer a child now. You are one of the people who needs to protect other people.
Yes. So again, with the coming of age and destiny.
Yeah. Destiny.
Well, see, I think destiny was originally more of a fluid concept. It wasn't a case of this is in your future, Harry, kind of. You know, there's a prophecy about a chosen one or anything like that. I think it was more a case of, well, this is your career path.
Yeah.
You're 14 now, you're old enough.
Old enough to have children and die. Go, off you go.
Well, yeah, because those were the things of life, weren't they?
Yeah.
But the... You know, the handing of a sword to a chosen one, which is how it was building on this, has been done, obviously, quite tongue-in-cheek by David Eddings in the Belgariad.
Mm-hmm.
And Garion, for some reason, has never noticed that he has a perfect circular birthmark on one hand, or rather, he doesn't think about it very often, and that he's heard legends about mystical orb all the time. It's like... And as the reader, you're sat there going, yeah, okay, Garion, please tell me if you're going to be king, you're actually not as stupid as we think you are right now. But again, they finally reunite him with the orb, which is set in the pommel stone of a great sword. And then you have the Sword of Truth series by Terry Goodkind, where Richard Rull quite literally is given the Sword of Truth. And that does lead him on a quest. I mean, it is kind of a magic sword. They're both magic swords, in fact.
So, with all these swords, that begs the question of what did it mean when Frodo got a ring? I didn't mean that in a gross way.
Of course not.
That's where your mind went. Because you're a dirty human being.
Well, Frodo inherits the ring from Bilbo.
That makes it worse.
And your mind went there. But no, I think the One Ring is really worth looking at because it's the personification of all the evil in Middle-earth. It is the weapon of the enemy. And you'd expect the weapon of the enemy probably to be a sword or you know, perhaps a big bomb or something like that. It's not. It's a tiny, unprepossessing gold ring that looks really simple. It's not even as flashy as the elves' rings or dwarves' rings or anything like that.
In fact, the whole concept was that it wasn't flashy in the least.
No, and you could have mistaken it for anything, except when it worked its will on you, and it just made you want it and want to put it on. It brought all your worst traits out. Part of the reason that Bilbo is able to hold on to it for so long is in part probably because Sauron's not as active at that point, but also because as a hobbit, Bilbo has very little there for the ring to work upon. And Frodo, there's even less in his character naturally for the ring to work upon. And it still almost defeats him by the end of the third book.
Yeah, though Frodo does go through quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, he's fundamentally changed forever, isn't he?
Yeah.
As a character. And it's, I just think it's, I know it's partly based on Wagner's ring cycle, but it's a really interesting concept that you've got this one tiny thing, a ring which has always been used traditionally to signify a promise or a covenant.
Yeah.
And that's actually the most dangerous object in Middle-earth. It's the one thing on which the entire horrible and all-encompassing war focuses on, all the races of Middle-earth. What happens to them is based entirely on whether the ring is destroyed or not.
Yeah. And it is an interesting thing, because this is an example of an object which gets put into a person's hand and propels them into being a hero, not because it provides them with something good, but because it challenges them with something evil.
Yeah, Frodo's put in danger immediately. In the books, danger isn't apparent immediately, but it's definitely there. And he's running for his life. I mean, he's never ever going to be safe even if he gets rid of the ring, because they will hunt him down and torture him for information on his whereabouts.
Yeah.
So his two choices are to journey forward and try and destroy it, or to accept it and try and master it and be destroyed by it.
Yeah. So not really great choices.
Not great choice. A choice, but not really great choices.
Yeah. And yeah, it is interesting because the ring is constantly trying to hinder Frodo.
Yes. It only helps him when it's in the ring's best interest to do so. And it's not really a conscious entity, it's just part of Sauron that's sort of been broken off and poured into this one device. Like a Horcrux. Sauron Horcrux, he just made.
Amateur. That would have been, can you imagine? So I've just imagined where they destroy the one ring and Sauron's just like, ah ha ha! I made more!
Frodo's like, I can't carry anything else to Mount Doom, I just can't do it.
Make someone like, else do
right,
it.
Mr. Frodo, I'll carry you.
So yeah, this is an example of an object which is not, which makes a hero, but it's the linchpin, but it's not the ring which actually makes Frodo into a hero. It's because of the ring that Frodo becomes a hero.
Yeah. What's interesting really is right at the very edge, when he's about to throw the ring in, Frodo actually fails in his quest.
Yeah.
The ring finally dominates him, and it's as much luck and, if you like, the universe trying to reset itself. He's obviously got it that far. Sam's got it that far.
Yeah.
But it is actually a failure. He technically fails as a hero on the hero's journey there at the very last hurdle.
Yes, he does. Which is something that isn't really ever really discussed that much. But he does. He does fail. He gets the whole way there, and he doesn't actually pass the final test.
No. And I think it's at that point you realise that the real test hasn't been all the hardships and all the suffering he's gone through on the way. It is actually that last, can you relinquish power?
And the answer was no. He couldn't. Which is devastatingly sad, actually.
It is really sad, but then it's his own mercy in sparing Gollum in the first place. That means that the ring does get destroyed, so it's almost like his own kind act come back to haunt him.
Or rather, his own kind acts actually Maybe he does win in that sense. Maybe his heroicism was about his kindness.
Yes. And the fact that he was willing to make the journey in the first place.
Yeah. Because as you say, if he hadn't done it, then if he hadn't saved Gollum and spared him, then Gollum could have never gone crazy at the end and taken the ring and subsequently destroyed it.
Yeah. As unintentional as it was, as unplanned as it was, the fact that he has generally behaved well all the way through does actually make him a hero, even though he does technically fail. It's interesting. It's a sort of circular argument. You go round and round, and you could say, well, does he really win? Because in a way, he's left so fundamentally altered that it's cost him too much. There's not very much left of him.
Yeah.
And you can tell he's never really going to get better as well.
Which is, again, very tragic. Very, very. And Bilbo isn't really going to get better either.
No. Mind you, but Bilbo has actually had quite a reasonable long life.
Yeah. Whereas Frodo probably had it a little bit harder. Anyway, we just talk about Lord of the Rings all the time. I've just realised I'm thinking of another thing where it's an example of, rather than an object, it's an animal that has come into someone's life. And you know, we talk about the dragons and stuff like that. But the Tenth Kingdom.
Yeah.
Ordinary girl and a dog comes into her life. She ends up getting stalked by a wolf creature man.
You really must watch the rest of that sometime.
I really need to get the DVD and just binge it.
Tenth Kingdom. Yeah. Really, really good, and it is a sort of fairy tale mashup with, you know, the fairy tales being real in one dimension, and then it intersects with ours, and as you say, a dog, without any spoilers, a not very ordinary dog, literally crashes into a girl on her bike as she's on her way to work, and
changes everything.
She could have just left the dog there, but she didn't. She's a decent person. She tries to look after the dog, takes it with her to work. And as you say, from there,
it all goes downhill.
There is a ring later on in that series, by the way.
It's all about rings and swords, isn't it?
It's definitely not like the One Ring, but I don't know. You'll have to see it. You make up your own mind.
And I've just thought of another one, another example, which is moving away from fantasy and spec fiction. Voltron. I introduced you to the first episode of Voltron, Legend, Defenders of Earth, or Defenders of the Universe. I can't remember what it's called. The new Voltron series, which is fantastic. Where group of pretty much ordinary teenagers discover giant robotic blue lion, which leads them into becoming, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy. See what I did there. and sort of they end up, you know, in this war zone against this terrible people called the Galra, which is, again, you know, there's this element of the fact that they were kind of destined to do it. Like, you know, they were all sort of trained pilots, which is possibly where, you know, they ended up in the situation that they were in. But they were acutely designed for what they ended up doing. So there's this element of destiny to it as well. Yeah. But none of it would have happened if they hadn't just found this lion.
As objects go, this is not small, it's not portable, and it's definitely not prepossessing, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah. It is. It's just pick up an object, life changed forever. So, it's not always about the magical object, as you know, as we can see, it's also about the, you can have the sci-fi version as well. Though I wonder whether you can classify Voltron as sci-fi. It's something, but
technically, I suppose, they're in space.
Yeah, but that's pretty much the only. But they have technology, but it's pretty unfounded, all of it. It's basically space magic. It's not like.
Okay, one of my favourite objects is, I thought of another one now, but I'll get on to that in a moment, is the Weird Stone in The Weird Stone of Risen Ganon. And I absolutely love it. It's one of those fantasy books that I think really got me onto proper fantasy in the first place at a very young age. I think I was about 7 when I read it originally. And that's dark for a 7-year-old. It's Alan Garner, and it's all based on Celtic mythology originally, and it's set in Old of the Edge.
Oddly enough, it's set around where my dad grew up, quite close to where my dad grew up. So he was big fans of the books as well, because they were set quite close to in Cheshire and Knutsford. I think that's right. I'm thinking of the right thing.
I thought Old of the Edge was in Yorkshire.
Hold on a second, I might be getting confused.
There's probably a couple of Old of the Edges in fairness.
I'll investigate that, but anyway, continue.
Yeah, there's obviously the Nordic tradition, and it actually is a Celtic one as well, of the Day of Ragnarok, or the Day of Reckoning, being seen in the future, and by then the great evil force will have put enough of itself in all the hearts of men, and presumably women, that it won't be defend, we won't be able to defend against it, the world will end. So the solution was to create an army that's greatness will be in pureness of heart and courage rather than in greatness of numbers. And it's the story of the 100 sleepers under the mound, and each one has a milk white horse, except for one. The wizard could only find 99 pure milk white horses of the right age at the time he was casting the enchantment for the sleepers. So he waited and waited for the perfect horse tunnel, and when he did finally find the right horse, a farmer was taking her to market to sell her. He offered to buy the horse instead, and leads the farmer and the horse off into, basically he's got like this cave full of wizard stuff and jewels and all the sorts of
wizard stuff.
Wizard stuff. It, inside the edge, if you like. And he's so busy sort of congratulating himself and putting the horse to sleep next to its rider that he doesn't, and he just sort of waves to the farmer and says, look, take whatever you think's fair payment. He doesn't notice that the farmer walks off with the keystone for the entire bloody enchantment. And it's only when he turns around and thinks, oh yeah, fine, he's obviously filled his pockets a few times with gold and gems and things, and then it's like, the weird stone's gone. Where's the weird stone? Maybe it's just lost. By the time he's decided it's not lost, the farmer's died, and the weird stone is lost to history. But it gets passed down in that farmer's family until it comes to a girl called Susan. And she and her brother are staying with their, well, it was actually her mother's nurse, I think, family. And she doesn't realise that what she calls her tear is actually the weird stone of Risen Ganon. And it starts off this fantastic adventure, and ultimately it changes her permanently as well. If you get on to the second book, you can tell that basically the Pleiades, the sisters, come down from the sky and ask her to ride with them. And when you get onto the third book, you've got Colin, who's her brother even, trying to locate his lost sister who disappeared into the Pleiades. So I mean, it's got the same sort of poignant, tragic feel as a lot of Celtic mythology.
Yeah.
It was all started by the weird stone of Risen Ganon, carrying an artifact and then getting it placed by one of the bracelets of the moon goddess, meant that ultimately she never would end up leading a normal human life.
No.
But absolutely great books. Definitely read them if you haven't.
There's another poignant example of an object which ends up changing people's lives, which isn't necessarily an obvious one, but it's the wardrobe in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Yes.
And again, the wardrobe, it's in the title. It is an object. Yes, it's a doorway, but it begins with an object.
It's even better than that. In The Magician's Nephew, it starts off with rings. It's the rings that allow them to travel between worlds, and hence they discover Narnia and where it's been created.
Yeah.
And then when Dick and Polly move back, when they get back into their own world, Dick buries the rings in the garden, and he's brought a magical fruit back from Narnia in the date of its birth to give to Mother, who's dying of cancer. She gets better. He plants the book off with the rings, and a great big apple tree grows up. And when the tree comes down in the storm, he has the tree made into a wardrobe, which gets put in a spare room of the great house he lives in the country, which four children then discover a magical land through.
Yeah.
You know, they're obviously, they're, you find out the origins of the wardrobe park.
Yeah, which is beautiful, actually. It's a nice little idea. But again, it all starts with objects. And rings! Rings!
Yes, rings for travelling.
Well, it does seem to often be a thing, which is that it's jewellery or swords.
Yes. I suppose because at one point they were both everyday objects. I mean, the swords
I mean,
are probably a bit
they still
more
are.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Far more like to find someone wearing a ring than wearing a sword now on an everyday basis.
Just because you're not trying hard enough, Jules.
I totally wear a sword in public, but I know I'd get stopped.
I mean, one could also, in Harry Potter, one of the big changes for him, which is actually quite subtle, is him getting the invisibility cloak.
Yeah, you don't realise it till you read the last book, but he's actually given a Deathly Hallow like a third of the way through the first book.
Don't you love Dumbledore?
So it'll be right for him to play with this.
This won't get him into any dangerous, terrible situations. It's fine.
But it's interesting that it is the Hallow that's the most protective, probably the least harmful of the Hallows. And he gives him that one, obviously thinking that he needs protection, which is a fair observation when it comes to Harry.
Yeah, but he needs protection, but he also needs, like, he knows that Harry sneaks out at night and stuff like that and gets up to all sorts of nonsense. And he's like, hey, you know what would help with that? This cloak of invisibility.
Another one where it's an object is, have you ever seen the Dark Crystal?
I try to forget, Jules. I try to forget.
That's another really good one. Again, obviously it's dark. It's quite dark and quite haunting, but you've got this little gelfling, one of the weak, like a hobbit almost, and he's given a crystal shard to heal the great dark crystal. He must do it by the time the great conjunction happens.
No pressure.
And
why do they give this stuff to children? I really don't understand.
I suppose it's for the same reason that Frodo ends up with the ring, isn't it? They're the most uncorrupted, and the evil objects don't have as much effect on them until... So, you know, it's a time frame thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, otherwise it's really, really irresponsible.
But yeah, it's a really, I don't want to call it a trope, but it's something we see a lot of, and I think it's definitely informed a lot of, you know, fantasies that we have as children. And I think actually a reason that it is really popular is that it allows again for this idea that you can be living an ordinary life and an extraordinary thing can happen to you.
Yeah, and that's not really so far in the realms of fantasy. I mean, you might not find a magical object, you might not be handed a magical sword, but sometimes a really small object like finding a letter in a book that you've just bought can send you off on an adventure.
Yeah. It can. But I think that reading books and stuff like that has given me a really warped expectation of what happens when I pick up old things.
Okay, well, it's not doing anything. It's clearly broken.
Take me on an adventure!
What would have ruined it for me is the bedknobs and broomsticks. It's not making me travel to faraway exotic lands.
Yeah. Well, we love it. I think that is a story type which is never really going to get old.
No, I do agree with that. And everybody loves a good quest story.
Everyone loves a good quest story. What I would be curious to see would be to see other examples of stories where the object, like the ring, isn't actually for the benefit of the main character. And I guess the other example of that is, as you said, the Dark Crystal.
Yeah, I mean, it's not actively malevolent, but it does attract everything that's trying to stop him.
Yeah.
So he gets attacked a lot.
Yeah. But can you think of any other examples where they get given something which is actually actively trying to thwart them throughout?
Not off the top of my head. I'm sure there are, but
that may be a gap in the market. Ah. So yeah, okay. Final question then. If you could have any object from any of these stories dropped into your hand, Jules, which would you take?
Well, it wouldn't be the one ring.
Fair.
I think probably the alethiometer.
Yeah? Why?
You learn how to read it and you can predict roughly what's going to happen in the near future. And you know what everybody else is doing. Basically, you've got unlimited knowledge.
Fair, fair.
What about you?
Goodness me. I wouldn't mind a dragon.
Okay. I don't think you want someone to drop a dragon on you.
No, like, I wouldn't mind getting a dragon egg and hatching it and forming a bond with it. You know, hopefully also with the same understanding that the government aren't going to come and try and take my dragon away from me. But I wouldn't mind a dragon egg or yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm pretty much up for anything. I wouldn't mind finding a giant blue lion either that I could
be pretty cool.
Ride into outer space. That would be pretty awesome. I'm still looking, Jules. I'm still looking. Though, yeah. I've just realised I'm writing two... The next two books that I'm writing both feature characters who just have something dropped into their hands and end up being ripped onto an adventure.
Yeah.
One of which is the Kestrel Saga, obviously, which we've spoken about before. So, yeah.
I don't have any magical objects coming up in my books. I need to fix that.
Yeah, gosh. Where are your magical objects? You need. Everyone knows that you need magical objects so that you can sell merchandise.
Noted.
And on that note, guys, we'll catch you next week.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.